You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Ivo Van Hove, Kings of Criticism podcast. We're going to be here. There's going to be a dinner break.
It does feel sort of Ivo Van Hove-ish. Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weiner-Kent, and I'm here with...
Associate Editor Deep Tran.
And our special guest, Helen Shaw.
Hello.
Critic at large, brilliant critic for four columns, Time Out, Voice, occasionally American Theater, when we can get it right for us. And we're here to talk about a couple topics. We have an interview I recorded a couple weeks ago at the conference with Josh Hecht, who runs Profile Theater, which is like Signature. It's like a mini Signature theater that does a whole season about on one playwright's work. They're just finishing up their Chiara Alegría Hudes season, and Josh has announced an exciting new season of Lisa Cronin and Edvir Smith. So that will come in a second. But first, we'll talk. We will just have our usual bull
banter
session.
About
yes, about topics of the day. And we thought we would start by talking about, we haven't really talked about it on the podcast, the HowlRound critical bias piece. Full disclosure, the piece was pitched to us first. Or maybe not first, but it was also pitched to us. I chose not to publish it. I can tell you about that in a second why, but let's...
Do you want to describe it though, Rob?
Yeah.
What it is?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
We should describe that, yes.
Is it Sarah Warner? Is the main,
well,
main
it's
writer?
Actually, they build it as a collective letter.
Yeah.
And it's on HowlRound. It's called A Collective Call Against Critical Bias.
Right.
And it's signed by a bevy of really awesome ladies.
Yeah, some writers for us. Zoe Colbert's
yep.
Written for us, and Martha Stecchetti.
Yep. Yep. Joan Lipkin.
Some great names.
Jill Dolan. Yeah.
It was based on a discussion that started on Twitter. Really, with Paula Vogel and Lynn Nottage, because their plays Indecent and Sweat had announced closing dates earlier than
anticipated.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the other two big new plays on Broadway, Oslo and A Doll's House, both written by men, did not close. And, you know...
And one won the Tony for it.
Right. So there's certainly a conversation that could be had about that, but what started out was a sort of... conversation. It was about how the fact that Ben Brantley and Jesse Green, the two main critics at the Times, were lukewarm on the play. What's the tweet say?
The tweet is Brantley and Green 2-0, Nodge and Vogel 0-2. Lynn, they helped close us down and gifted straight white guys runs. Our play will last.
Right.
And so they basically laid the blame of the closing of those plays at the feet of Brantley and Green.
Right. I mean, I think... It started there. The conversation got a little more interesting and more broad and talked about bias and other aspects of the, like, funding, other aspects of bias besides these two critics. So I think if you want to make it about that, and also the fact that largely, as we've talked about many times, the critical field is too white and too male.
And that's, those white males write very, I think, but the essay was about how these white men write problematic things, which then deter audiences from the plays.
Right. That's where I part ways with this particular analysis of that.
Yeah,
I think you could make that case.
Yeah, but it was touching on like a larger issue of critical bias,
right.
and how these preconceptions these critics bring in inform how they view the plays that are not within their preference. Is that
sure?
Fair?
I mean, yes. I think that was what was alleged. Again, I think that you can make a case like that using these two particular shows and these two particular critics. I don't think you get the best argument going about it. Obviously, there's been a great discussion that started, but that's just, you know, I obviously even described it with my opinion, and
yes,
I would love
you
to,
did
I'd love
describe
to hear,
it with your opinion.
I'd love to hear. Well, I prefaced it by saying we didn't publish it, and there was a reason, but I'd love to hear other thoughts on it. We brought you and Helen to ask you what you thought.
And a lady critic. You know, the trouble I find in the piece is that the language of it is statistical, but the arguments are anecdotal. And there's a fundamental sort of disagreement on the level of the argument about is this letter protesting implicit bias in a monolithic critical culture, which is, with very few exceptions, white, and once you get to the top level, male. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the particulars of the protest are not great pieces of evidence in and of themselves, and also implicit bias is provable only through broad analysis, only through a deep dive into the actual numbers in the field.
Right.
And, you know, I've been reading very slowly the book Thinking Fast and Slow, which is, in fact, about the way that the human mind is quite bad at thinking statistically. What we see is pretty much all there is for us. When we see two plays by enormously beloved women playwrights close, that becomes for us a representation of a field that has historically been very cruel to women. Now, so I have trouble with this specific letter. Mm-hmm. It moves from the general, it moves from the specific to the general in ways that are, if they were in conversation, would be acceptable, but are not to me convincing in the letter. Particularly, it moves into sort of almost a pastiche of the argument against Hilton Owls, in which there is a sentence that critiques him for the way he describes Lee Silverman's career, and then the next sentence says, "This is what he says about women," and that is right. not how argument works. We aren't actually allowed to move from the specific to the general in that way, unless you are looking across a person's writing career.
Right.
So do I have sympathy with the idea that there is bias in both in my own profession and also in the theatrical world? Lord, of course.
Yeah.
I've wept over it this season for my own personal frustrations with my career and looking at the broader scope. But I have to say this letter did not prove its point for me because I thought it actually managed to argue against itself almost point by point.
Fascinating. I put it better than I could have. I think
I think that was a very fair way of putting it. And I think, I mean, granted, like, I feel like my entire career has been talking to critics about their implicit bias and telling critics to be more sensitive in writing about these topics. And that is true. There is an issue with the way critics write about women, about people of color. Like, just, you know, just read Rex Reed's review of The Glass Menagerie or whenever he writes about women. The issue is there. The problem is, and, you know, Rob is my editor and he tells me this all the time, it's like when you're trying to make this kind of argument and you're trying to get people to understand where you're coming from, you need the evidence needs to be solid and it needs to be provable across, like Helen said, across a body of work. And you need to anticipate all of the arguments that people will make against your argument. And the thing is, when I read it, it made me think of like Charles Isherwood's review of Sweat and how much he loved it. And it is that review which helped push it to the public theater.
He also loved Indecent, too.
And he also loved Indecent.
This is a weird accident of timing that another white male critic at the Times was let go or left, parted ways with the Times, let's say, before those shows opened on Broadway. And his positive reviews probably it's a counterfactual. We'll never know what would have happened if his inevitably rave, you know, probably rave reviews of the Broadway production of those shows, if it had influenced the critics, the audiences a different way. I mean, for me, as I think I wrote to you and maybe to you, Helen, as well, is, you know, patriarchy is a system in which we're all complicit. Audiences, producers, I think producers get off the hook in a story like this really, really, really easily, and critics. I think to single out critics for the closure of shows or for the problem of bias, certainly they're out there with their opinions, and you can point to examples, and there's evidence that you can build if you want to build a case. To me, to single out critics is the wrong target in a way. To single them out, make them, to talk about them as part of a larger system of bias. In other words, how they shape the taste of producers, how producers second guess what critics will like, what they won't like. That's a valid discussion of the of sort of the marketplace. But, you know, without talking about specific critics, critics are, independent critical voices to me are one of the best bulwarks we have against, or like a corrective we might look to. Unfortunately, it's not correcting as much as it could, up against patriarchy and racism. They're the folks who are out seeing plays that don't have a huge marketing budget, huge production. They champion the work of writers. They want to see new writers. And now they might have implicit biases. They might view the work of writers from marginalized communities in a biased way, right?
Or write really really virulently racist things, like Hedy Weiss says in Chicago. But that's what I loved about the arguments against her in that campaign, because this isn't just one review. This is a whole body of work, and we will assemble the evidence and show you why we are doing this.
Well, yeah, well, I didn't see the body of evidence there.
I saw patterns.
Well, can we talk about that one? The Hedy Weiss thing to me is also like, reminds me that if you poke at a critic, so often for valid reasons, for something where they misstepped or even have a pattern of that, you will get a lot of people coming out of the woodwork who have reasons, legit and otherwise, why they hate that critic. It's happened with me and Hilton Alice, who I have sort of made peace with the contributions that he has made to the field, because I do think he's a beautiful writer. I've argued with his criticism so much over the years, but I find myself in arguments with people who jump in to critique him and realize, wait, these people don't actually care about criticism. And that is, I'm not saying it in general.
I mean, but they have an opinion about it, and no, they're readers, and they should care.
They do.
People should.
They do care, but I guess what I'm talking
when people
specifically.
People care enough to like write to you about why they have a problem with what it is that you write. Like, I think there is an obligation to answer to
it's
that.
It's probably not fair to talk about this in terms of social media and the internet, but that's where a lot of this stuff is unfortunately argued, and it doesn't take long for discussion about a critic to have the voice added, like, fuck them all. Critics are all full of shit. They're all, and you know, it gets conflated a little bit with they're white and male and out of touch, and they're full of shit, and they wrote shit about my show, and you know what I mean? It's like,
well, if I may, I think that it's interesting that this, to return to the HowlRound piece.
Yeah.
Because I do so, so respect so many of the people who wrote it, and I, you know, I'm almost regretful that I can't agree with it more. And I think...
Yes, yeah, same.
I think that one of the... It's the fact that it was stimulated by these two tweets that might point to why it was so hard for them to write. Because those two tweets were then... if not disavowed, kind of a corrective tone, you know, when Paula Vogel would go on to tweet things like, oh no, I've served on juries with Ben Brantley. He is,
yes,
not the problem.
Course.
He's wonderful. And she had just tweeted out a score that he had won when she had closed.
Yeah.
So clearly the thing is that, and this ties into all the stuff that we wanted to talk about today,
yeah,
including the David Mamet talkback ban, which is that criticism does a very tough thing, which is that it hurts people's feelings. And that when someone's feelings have been hurt, and I don't mean to make that sound like a small thing.
Yeah, no.
They have done something so extraordinary and brave, which is that they've put art into the world. And then a critic, even when a critic says something positive, they've done something hurtful, which is they have dared to judge it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've judged it publicly. And my feeling is that in the same way that you don't talk about the show for two blocks around the theater,
yeah, right,
is that you allow all of the stuff to pass you by, which is said by an artist after the criticism has come out, because it is in this turbulent zone of hurt, despair in the case of a show closing, frustration, rage that someone has dared to judge your work. These are this is why on earth would we judge people's statements by this sort of difficult and sacred moment? And so the idea that you would write, I think that's probably where the HowlRound goes kind of off the rails for me so early, is that I look at those tweets and I think those are totally reasonable things to write when you found out your show was closing. Right. And the idea that everybody would be like, you know, you're absolutely right, and you would have said that in your coolest, soberest frame of mind as well, is where the trouble lies.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I thought one place I thought you were taking this is what happens to discourse on the internet with Twitter and Facebook, is it?
It's so quick. We're privy, and the written word, this is why it's so difficult to edit on page, is the written word looks right. It looks considered. We haven't broken ourselves of the idea that, wow, a guy named Gutenberg really must have spent some time over a print tray on this one when we see it printed.
Yeah.
And so when we see something printed on Twitter, it feels as though it is more substantial than it is, which is, we know that it is the product of 2 seconds thought.
And then I think, Helen, I think this is what you were getting at, is like there is an argument to be made for critical bias and how it can be very damaging to the discourse and to the artists.
Right.
Like when you write about, like, this actress disgusts me with the way she moved on stage, like that is right. damaging. And that is something that is not acceptable within critical discourse, and it's not above the critic to examine why these things are hurtful. But I don't think this essay in particular did the best of it didn't do the best job of arguing why critical bias is something people should care about.
Well, especially because it didn't have cases like that. I mean, you can't point to Rex Reed is I don't want to dismiss him, but he's a bit of an outlier in terms of
well, I mean,
John Simon's still writing for somebody
back
somewhere.
Back in the day, and people found it acceptable.
I thought it was so funny that Paula called out Paul Simon, or John Simon, positively. Like, I like a well-written pan, like John Simon.
John Simon said that an actress's body overshadowed her face.
Yeah.
I mean, now the thing is that he's a little bit of a straw man, because he's so outside what people would say today that it is, right. that it's kind of risible. But one of the things, and this is something that I do think is, the HowlRound piece, the comments under the HowlRound piece became so vituperative.
I couldn't go there. I couldn't go there.
I tried, and
Jonathan Mendel wrote some very like long considered pieces about things that he, problems within in the piece. Some people jumped on top of him. Other people claimed that implicit bias didn't exist. Then there was it just was such a rageaholic. It was very difficult to read. And then Pete Carroll wrote a response, sort of a response, saying this is what it's like to be a white man. I am now going through life as a white man, and these are the things that I've discovered. And there's a very personal response to the issues that were brought up in the piece. Not at all a statistical argument, very personal. And I thought, this is the difference between the essay and criticism. And it isn't that we can't have people that write both, but that it's much more persuasive in a way to read the essay on these topics than it is to read something which is, as I say, sort of like statistically couched.
Yeah.
Because Pete Carroll's argument is simply, let me just tell you what it's like for me. And you read it and you see the world through his eyes and you think, wow, that's new. That's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then of course, the comments on that were fine. We're fine.
Right.
You know, you put an I in something instead of a we, and suddenly it's
well,
not
also, if you don't
quite
make,
so controversial.
You don't, to me, it's also, if you're, it's not just statistical. They were making sort of a trade criticism.
Like a broad strokes, where these critics were responsible for closing these shows and ignoring the fact that women aren't produced on Broadway. Yes, in part because the tastemakers of critical tastemakers prevent that, but at the same time, also producers prevent that. Producers prevent that by not
audiences.
Choosing.
I mean, I would think.
Yeah. So it's like a whole system
of
bias. It's
a system of bias. It's true. It's historic and systemic. is the reason that so few make it to Broadway at all. And so they overdetermine the purported meaning of these two shows. As you say, these beloved writers, oh my God, they're closing on Broadway. Why can't Broadway support them?
Well, and, you know, I mean, I stand for this book whenever I can, which is Goldman's The Season.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, which is a portrait of the 1966-67 season on Broadway. I think that's right. Maybe it's 67-68.
Yeah.
And it is, wow, I mean, poof, it feels like it could have been written yesterday. And there's a fantastic chapter on critics,
right?
Which is, which in fact points to the thing that happens in the HowlRound article, which is, okay, we can pretend that we're having a discussion about the critical establishment, but what we're talking about is the Times.
Yes, yes.
And mm-hmm. that it has been, if it was the case in 1967 and it's the case in 2017, you know, we are not, that has not budged. That particular boulder is not moving. And so, it's, anyway, it was very interesting to read him, point to the fact that it isn't fair. Broadway isn't fair. And when we try to apply the language of fairness, and democratization to something which is the bloodiest marketplace in the country, it is a confusion about what a marketplace is like. Right. Marketplaces are not fair. We should have all woken up by now to know that the invisible hand of the market is usually a slap in the face. And if you begin to argue why isn't Broadway fair, the idea that you would point to two people or in one case one person who right. writes for one outlet, it is... That is overstating the harm that he has done and wildly understating the harm that the market is doing.
I mean, there's so much to celebrate in the fact that they made it to Broadway, albeit
huge.
Belatedly.
Huge.
And that those plays are going to be that at least some of them will be on our most produced list. It's a. Mm-hmm. I think what made me sad was that to turn this sort of triumph into this sort of, you know, what looked like at the time sour grapes. And again, I think it led to a better discussion. There was an interview in the Boston Globe that Paula did, which was much more of a personal, like, we need to talk about bias. Mm. Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that really concerns me about the Hedy Weiss controversy and this one is that the people who need to be moved are magazine and newspaper editors, not nonprofit theaters, not us in this room, not the critics. They are the ones who need to be moved, the editors. And are they going to be moved by these arguments? I don't think so. In the case of Hedy Weiss, in the case of this, it looks like artists trying to work the refs. It looks like artists saying, I know this is not the case. This is not due justice to the arguments or the complaints about either any critics in this case. But a newspaper person looks at that and says, critics going to critique, right? Which is what the Chicago
That's
Tribune
what they
wrote.
Said, yeah.
It's like, we need, and I do, on principle, believe in independent criticism. We need to, that is the value that I hold in principle. Of course, I work at TCG where we can't print independent criticism so much. I'm working on that, though. It's an ongoing conversation.
Critics, we're very good at forgetting that we professionally hurt people.
Yeah.
And we actually, I'm afraid we have to kind of take the blows of that as well.
Right,
you know, if
right.
the public has to take it on the chin every now and then because they have a literal banner that says Bank of America above their seats, then I have to take it on the chin that people will shed no tears for me when it turns out that my job has dried up as it does for arts criticism everywhere.
Well, I mean,
everywhere.
That's the thing I'm fighting for. I feel like on the crudest level, we have to protect the critics' right to say mean things in public about artists. That's like, that's not the entire critical thing, but that is like the thing that feels to me
that's the
at bottom under threat. Like,
interesting.
I mean,
do that was and that's in the HowlRound article. The what do we call good? And why do we call it good? Which I think is there for me is the nut is the thing that becomes it preoccupies every critic because every critic you cannot just start and say I like this piece. You have to say I like this piece because
right.
And the question of how do we judge things good, I think is, that's the human condition. So where the HowlRound piece left me really interested is that it reminded me of what Gertrude Stein says in her piece on masterpieces, which is that things are classics almost immediately after they've been ugly. That we think things are ugly, and then we turn, we pivot, and we begin to think of them as masterpieces. Of course, she's thinking about her own work and also Picasso's work. That's interesting, is, you know, because look, full disclosure, if I had been the chief critic at the New York Times writing about Oslo, Doll's House, Indecent, and Sweat,
yeah,
I wouldn't have called any of them a masterpiece, and I would also have written mixed reviews.
Right, right.
And I have the woman card, you know? So I
right.
But what's interesting about that Howron piece is saying, in a way, saying, well, why? Why? What is it that you adjudicate as not beautiful in those pieces? What is it that you...
Right.
And how will that shift?
Well, and I don't think anyone is saying, like, you can't have a negative opinion of a piece of work. I think, I mean, Hilton Alves is a black man, and that has not stopped him from writing some very misogynistic things about women. And so it's not because you think, like, a person of color or a woman will be more gracious towards your work if they were in that chair. I think there's the issue of, and I don't think the Howron piece didn't say this, but I think the underlying sense is, for so long, the things that have been deemed good were deemed good by white men.
Right.
And so it goes back into the thing that we keep on going back to, which is, like, there needs to be more diverse voices in these positions of power who can adjudicate what is good and what is not. And the hope is that if there are those people, like, they maybe, like, what they like will be more diverse than what has come before.
Could I also just add one adjective to that, which is visible people of power? Mm-hmm. Because the editorial board at the New York Times is, I don't know the numbers, so I can't say majority, but it is very female, very female. And the writers in the theater stable are hugely female. Hugely female. Congratulations, ladies. I just called you hugely female. but that isn't the trouble. It isn't that there aren't brilliant women writing at the Times, and it's not that there aren't brilliant women editing at the Times.
Right.
It's that there are two visible positions. The visible positions are occupied by men. Now, the same goes with artistic directorships. Yeah. Look around the country at every major ballet company. Ballet companies yet. And they're all men.
No, it's true. I think I don't like to look at diversity as instrumental in the way that we want to do it so that we get nicer reviews for certain artists or certain groups of artists.
So. I think it's more fair.
Well, in my experience, it's been that it's just worth doing because it's right and doing it for its own sake to have a more diverse pool to cover a more diverse theater scene. In my experience, this is true also working with you, Deep. Working with writers from different backgrounds, whether it's class, race, whatever educational background, it's not just that they might have a different lens for certain kinds of work. They just have a different lens. Like I find the diversity of opinion, again, not just about diversity is what I'm saying, is really bracing and interesting. Wesley Morris has a really interesting voice as a film critic and as a critic at large, for instance, African-American. Hilton Alves has certainly a very unique, very unique is a terrible phrase. he has a one-of-a-kind voice. Even before he was the theater critic, I had huge issues with Hilton Alves, and I've still do, but I think he's written some beautiful, beautiful stuff. And, you know, God, with a theater scene without Hilton Alves' voice, this goes back to the True North was a talk about hurt feelings. I'm going to misquote it a little bit, but Lynn Nottis told me years ago, this is before Hilton became sort of a champion of hers, that it hurt her feelings that there were no writers of color reviewing her work. She wasn't saying only writers of color will get her work, but to not have that voice anywhere in the discourse, she said was a, and I felt like that is that's a disservice to an artist like that. Mm. It's a disservice to all artists and to the arts that there's not a more diverse pool.
The hire of Jesse Green at the Times taught me a little something about hurt feelings because I am an enormous fan of his writing. And when I learned that he had the job, I remember thinking, well, he is the best writer of any of us writing this is justice. How wonderful. This is justice. I believe in writing more than I believe in anything. And I still believe that. I still think that. I still think, you know, it is what a gift it is for the people who get to read him.
Right.
Now, however, and I actually think this is kind of important, it also hurt my feelings because you cannot look around the country. You cannot find a market in this country that has a major theater scene, that has a chief critic who's not a white man. And I know I said to you, Rob, in a heartbroken email, that this is, that strange little coterie, those 10 positions, is our Supreme Court. And we don't have a woman on the Supreme Court right now.
You don't even have Sandra Day O'Connor.
We don't have Sandra Day O'Connor. That's 1981, right?
Right.
So
let alone Sonia Sotomayor.
How backwards can we be? Reagan appointed Sandra Day O'Connor. So and then I kept thinking, now, do my hurt feelings matter? Does it matter that I'm crying over this and I am a steel jawed, ice-hearted critic. I never cry at anything. I was, this thing was actually just, it was making me cry on the subway. And I thought, well, you know, my own hurt feelings don't particularly matter. But the fact that those hurt feelings writ large.
Yeah.
What woman would want to do this job if they know they can't be promoted?
Hmm.
What person of color would want to do this job when they know that the editor of the Times thinks that diversity can't be solved with a single hire, which is literally the only way that you can solve a diversity problem?
Right.
There's the thing is that it will simply stifle the desire to do it.
Right.
And that matters more than anything, because if we're going to make a diverse critical body, you have to want people who want to be critics.
Right.
And right now, if I knew what I know now, and I was starting when I was 25, would I do this? I don't know. And that is shocking that I am at 40, I'm 15 years into a critical career, and I'm starting to think, this is too sad. This is too sad to do. And someone who shall not be named, who might be sitting at this table, texted me and said, how do you stay positive? And I said, I'm not positive. I'm not positive. So that's killing, you know? That is a killing blow to critical diversity. And I wish they knew, but they don't.
The editors.
Who is they?
The editors.
Yeah.
I wish they knew. I wish they knew what that did to generations. Those jobs are held for lifetimes.
Yeah.
They are held for 12 years. Depending.
I was on a call today and they were asking me, like, you know, the question everyone wants to know, like, how do you solve the diversity problem? And like, what are people doing? And I said, it's not because there's no writers. Like, the writers are coming up and we can make our own platforms. We can write for we can write anywhere and we will write for no pay and we will write for just free tickets. But the thing is, there is no graduation from the world of writing for free to Jesse Green.
Right.
Like, there's very few opportunities to do this work consistently.
Right.
And to build and to build your skills and to also, like, make mistakes. And there is there's no room to develop as a writer. And so, like, that is the problem. This
I'm trying to make room, as much room as I can. It's so agonizing for me to this discussion, because it's a career that I also am in to an extent and care deeply about the future of, for the sake of its own sake, in some sort of pure platonic sense of criticism, but also for the sake of who's going to get to do it, right? That really, for a critic as great as you, Helen, to have that feeling of, you know, it's like when you hear about the great actor who's going to, you know, just move to the Midwest and raise a family and not do it, like Karen Olivo, right? You know, it's like, it's tragic, you know? So hopefully we can keep you well enough.
Well, you know, we're all thinking about employed. Angels in America all the time now, because, you know,
who
what's going on, and
right.
Isaac Butler's writing a book about it, and my, you know, who doesn't wake up every morning and do their daily read from Angels? It is kind of, the answer is actually just more. I actually think the answer is just more. If there is a way to make more platforms, then I think the water will find its level. Because as you said, I mean, there's 1,000 people writing. I mean, my Lord.
You know, then that's what to me, if you've got speech you don't agree with, bad speech, the answer is to speak back and do more and better speech. I mean, this is the case when I felt about the Hedy Wise situation, as well as, you know, in general. Like, again, I don't think the HowlRound people or folks who are signing on to this sort of call are saying shut down the critics or shut them up. You can hear that voice in there if you look for it. But I think the answer is to get more voices in the conversation, more and better, and not, you know. I guess what we're worried about, those of us who've done it for a while, is like, voices falling silent, not because they're being shut down, because no one's listening to them and no one's paying them, no one's hiring them. And you know, that person who's going to be mean to artists in public, is it going to have to be just someone standing outside the theater with a megaphone going, that performance was, you know,
Jejun,
I tell you. Yes, no, look it up.
That's not right. That isn't the best part of the job. It's just
it's the part you have to protect.
Belly
though.
Up to if we're going to do it.
Well, you know, this has been a great conversation. Thank you for coming in for that discussion. We'll come back and have some recommendations afterwards. Hopefully, the good part of your job. Talking about things you like. Here's my interview with Josh Hecht. He runs Profile Theater in Portland, and we talked a few weeks ago in Portland. Here's Josh Hecht. So I'm here with Josh Hecht, Artistic Director of Profile Theater, not to be confused with Profiles Theater in Chicago. Yes. Profile Theater here in Portland, which is a little bit like Signature in that it takes a playwright, the old Signature, the original Signature, where it takes a playwright per season. Is that correct?
Right. What I've been saying is we put a single playwright at the center of our season and use her vision as a lens on our shared world.
Okay, that's cool. But it means, in practical terms, that means you do a bunch of plays by the same writer, but then you program other things around it?
Correct, exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
And this you're halfway through a Chiara...
Allegria Hudi's season.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you program that? Was it already programmed before you got to...
It was a collaboration. So she had already been announced as the next playwright, but the actual season hadn't been set yet. So
okay.
Lauren Bloom Hanover, the interim AD, and I collaborated on what a season of her work might look like.
Okay. Now, Tanya Barfield was last season, I remember. Mm-hmm. Has this always been Profile's mission?
The single player at the center of the season? Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did they take the idea from Signature? Or?
Our founder, Jane Unger, was inspired by Signature.
Signature,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you just started, you told me, you got here 5 months
That's
ago.
Right.
But
yeah.
you were in a position sort of...
Since the summer, right.
Summer.
And so in the fall, I was consulting and going back and forth from New York to Portland. And then in January, I made the move.
So, was running a theater something that you always wanted to do? Did you found a company with your college friends at one point? Were you one of those company people or no?
I didn't, but
no.
You know, I'd worked at MCC Theater for a number of years
as
the director of playwright development. And then I left that and was a freelance director for about 8 years. And I loved that and loved being able to follow the work all across the country. But I'd started to feel like I missed being part of a bigger conversation about the role of theater in our cities and what we want from a theater.
Right.
And I missed being able to engage with an audience in a more long-term way.
Right,
you know, as
right.
a freelancer, I'd power shoot into a city, you know, maybe meet the audience at 2 previews and then leave. So I've really enjoyed being able to think proactively about community engagement and civic engagement.
That's a big part of the job of any artistic director, but especially, I imagine, in a place like Portland.
For sure. And Profile had a director of community engagement for the last 4 years, so they've been putting a lot of human capital and financial capital into that programming for a while. It's really central to our mission.
I do remember, was it in HowlRound, the piece you wrote?
Mm-hmm.
That was really, we shared it. I came across it months after you posted it, I think, and we reshared it. I'll reshare it with this podcast. It was a great... I mean, could you sum that up for me again one
sure.
more time? It was about community engagement.
It was. So we are in the middle of a 3-year diversity and inclusion initiative where we're only programming women writers and writers of color for 3 years.
Right.
And part of what we have been exploring is how to integrate that into an organic narrative of our company. it surprised me the number of people who said, well, with the new mission. And I would say, well, the mission hasn't changed.
Right.
We've just refocused the lens in terms of how we're interpreting the mission. So how to make it seem not like a shift, but
yeah.
like the next step in our story
okay.
is something that we've spent a lot of time thinking about recently.
So have you chosen the next playwright?
We have. We're doing a special 18-month double season featuring the work of Lisa Crane and Anna DeVere Smith in conversation for 18 months.
Wow. That's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, we're really excited about it.
Wow, and how did you come up with that idea?
Well, you know, in part, it struck me that the core of the initiative is about challenging ourselves to see our own story in other people's stories,
right?
No
right.
matter what our background is.
Yeah.
And we thought that a great way to do that expansively would be to culminate the initiative with this kind of explosive 18-month season in which we're actively asking these two artists to
right.
see themselves in each other's stories and our audience.
I feel like that resonates so much with both of their work
mm-hmm.
because I feel like Lisa talks a lot about that and her work is about
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, for sure.
And Anna, of
she
course.
She literally embodies
yeah,
person
exactly.
after person after person.
Now, I'm only aware of a few. Orkin Shakespeare, many years ago, was going to do Twilight as a multi-character piece
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
for some reason it was taken off the season. I know that's been done, maybe not professionally, but it's like that's been done in high schools or like...
Mm-hmm.
with different people playing the parts,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you could tip your hand about whether you're going to do that kind of thing, but obviously it's not going to be her performing her own work
correct.
At your theater.
One of the things I'm really excited about is the final production of the season will be Lisa's play Well in rotating rep with Anna's play Let Me Down Easy.
Oh, my God.
The same six actors playing both of those.
That's such a brilliant thematic because they're both
so they'll finally
healthcare.
That's
yeah,
right.
Gee whiz. That's amazing. What did... I also think formally this is such an interesting, because Lisa, I wouldn't say she backed into playwriting, but she
mm-hmm.
came from another place and
mm-hmm.
is now like making her version of the well-made play. And then
mm-hmm.
Anna DeVere Smith is a playwright, but a playwright by sort of other means, you know, in a way.
That's right.
You know?
Yes, and both of them have come out of either a solo or a devised tradition
yeah.
or both. Both of them are politically engaged for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Both of them are really interested in the nexus of art and action.
Yeah, yeah.
And both of them, as you say, have moved into more traditional forms.
Right.
Anna has a new series on HBO that is filming this coming year. So
did
she's been working in a lot of different media.
Is it based on her kind of theater work, or
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know. Okay,
I don't
know. Is you going to do In the Wake, this screenplay, or you don't know?
We don't know.
You don't yet. Okay, yeah. I'm just. I think that play deserved another
yes.
pass.
Yes.
I think it was all there. It was fascinating to see her do that. It felt like a Kushner stab in the Kushner direction, but
yes.
it was really, but in a great way. Like
she and I have had a few conversations about that play and about. What she's interested in exploring in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, and it was Lee directed it, I think, Lee Silverman?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was a play that deserved, it didn't get onto the top 10 list. It wasn't
right,
done
yes.
a lot. I don't know if she held on to it, but anyway, that's a play I'd love to see.
It's also shockingly
again.
Relevant again, I mean, because that
that's
play
right.
is set right after
that's
the
right after
election in 2000.
And yeah, no, but when she was interrogating, I remember I talked to her about it for a feature about interrogating the left's response to
mm-hmm.
the situation,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And the sort of fallacy of American exceptionalism.
Yeah, what's that character that, the skeptical character, the working class character in that, who's
mm-hmm.
just like, I forget the Deirdre played, or Deirdre.
Right. O'Connell, yes.
Yeah, God, that was harrowing stuff, but great. I loved it. A lot of rich stuff there.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So do you feel like, here's what I wanted to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Had you been to Portland before? Do you have a sense of the Portland scene? You're the interloper from New York.
I am an interloper from New York. It's true. I had been here once before. I did a workshop of Dan O'Brien's play, The Body of an American, at JAW.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 5 years ago or so.
Before the Portland Center stage production,
correct.
Right? Okay,
yeah.
The Bill Tarrasch.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So I'd been here for a couple of weeks, but hadn't really been back until this process brought me out here again. And, you know, I mean, there's some ways that Portland is very familiar to me in
yeah.
that it's a left-leaning city. It's a very sort of literate cultural city.
Yeah.
I've been really surprised and impressed at the incredible breadth of cultural offerings here. For a city of only 625,000 people,
yeah.
there's a ton of arts organizations, and there's a a community here that is really hungry for engagement.
Right,
and that's
right.
been exciting.
So I've talked to some folks who say that it is a great cultural city, and theater's not necessarily at the forefront of it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that, or that, that when you think about Portland culture, but this mm-hmm. is this is true of many cities, that they might have food culture, mm-hmm. they might have music culture, and but that Portland has some great theaters, but it's not necessarily at the center of people's mind. Obviously, you're going to change all that, right?
Exactly. And within the next 6 months, for sure. But, you know, I will when I got my haircut recently, my barber said, oh, yeah, we have tickets to go to Portland Center Stage tonight.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, and he was not the sort of typical what we think of when we close our eyes and picture theater audience.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
And I will also say the other thing that has surprised me is the number of people who are camping nature enthusiasts who are also theater patrons and even theater supporters and donors and board members.
Really?
One of my first trips here, one of our board members said, I just got back from a 3-day camping trip in the Cascades. And I said, oh, you rented like a cabin? He said, no, in a tent. And that is not my picture of
a typical theater goer.
A typical theater board member.
Or board member, yeah, yeah. Oh, I just think that's the kind of person you meet here, right?
Yes.
That's what they,
for sure.
That's
yeah.
what they do.
Yeah.
So I imagine one of the reasons that you find it familiar is that, you know, it's a cliche or stereotype that's like Brooklyn, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's probably a good time to bring up how we met, which mm-hmm. is, coincidentally, when my first son was born, we didn't have room for my dad to stay with him. And so we looked, my wife and I lived in Greenpoint. We looked for a sublet, and my dad sublet your apartment.
That's right.
We lived in Josh Huck's apartment for about a month or two. And you were off directing.
And where was I? I can't remember.
It wasn't Humana because it was summer. It was,
right.
It was in July. Anyway, you were off doing something, and I think it certainly wasn't a requirement that the person be a theater person that we sublet from. But I discovered over the months that, or after over the time we were talking, that, oh, you're a director. And I just Googled you, and you directed at Humana and other
right,
places.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I also remember nearly giving your father a heart attack when I realized I'd forgotten something, and so snuck back into the apartment at about, 11 o'clock at night, and he was in his pajamas. I knocked, but he didn't hear me, so I just opened the door, and he came out into the kitchen, and I said,
sorry. I remember the story now. I think he handled that with aplomb.
Yes.
Yeah. But you had already left town, or you were about to leave?
I was leaving the next morning.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, he met you then, so it wasn't
right.
just a...
That's right.
Yeah, well... So that's a side story, which there's not much more to say other than, Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
Greenpoint.
Mm-hmm. Portland.
Portland.
Hipsters, makers, artisanal.
So does that maker thing resonate with you in any way? Or director? I don't know if directors...
Right.
You don't think of them as the hands-on people, right?
Yeah, right, right,
right.
I mean, I've been thinking about it in terms of the theater because there's something about, we've been thinking about the way that a playwright at the center of our season might also include a curatorial capacity. So
Okay. One
of the ways that I've been engaging with Kiara is to say to her, how do you identify community and how might we organize our community engagement efforts in a year-long way through that lens?
Right.
Or who are the up-and-coming writers that you are really excited about and that I'm really excited about, and can we program some development of that, sort of next generation of writers? What are the questions that you think are critically important, and how can we organize some of our in-dialogue programming through that lens of those questions? So in that regard, there is something that feels akin to Portland's kind of maker, artisanal sensibility.
Right, 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 right. Being thoughtful about that. I wonder, now that you're running a theater... You mentioned MCC. Are there other theaters that you think of as models or ones that you think are doing certain things right that you want to learn from or take from or look to?
I've definitely been in... I will say that I've been really moved by and thankful for the community of artistic directors and associate artistic directors. And in New York, before I moved here, we started a young ADs club with Will Davis and Nigel Smith and Michael Barakiva and Mike Walkup and Daniela Topol, and we would get together and just pick each other's brains. And all of those people have been huge resources for me. Adam MMR at Theater J.
Oh, no, she's Theater J now. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Sean Daniels at Merrimack. I've been thinking a lot about how he approaches engagement and bringing the community into his rehearsal process.
Right, right. So there's good peer-to-peer fellowship there, but do you feel like has there been mentorship, or do you feel like that's missing? It's okay if you say
it's a good question. You know, one of the people that I've been in a conversation with is Che Yu.
Yeah.
And that's been really helpful to me. And Bill, frankly.
Bill Rausch. Yeah, Che Yu and Victory Gardens.
Really, I think the way that he thinks of, again, engagement has been really inspiring to me.
Right, okay. Yeah, no, those are good name checks. I wonder, it's something I think about in my field in journalism, mentoring the next generation, mm-hmm. I know Ann Kaufman has talked a lot about how that's where she started that Sundance Directors Program. That's not it, artistic directors, but she felt mm-hmm. like there's all these programs for playwrights, mm-hmm. to develop new playwrights, but not so many for directors,
yeah,
right?
So
I guess for playwrights, of course, there's TV or teaching, right, mm-hmm. or grants. For directors, there's running a company mm-hmm. or teaching, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Do you feel, you know, this is something where I've talked to directors over the years, some of them really have a knack for running an institution as an art, as their art. I think mm-hmm. this is Bill talks about that. Bill talks about, he really thinks of that as creative.
Mm-hmm.
He does it creatively. And it's not like a headache to like, oh, administrative crap.
Mm-hmm.
But do you feel like, again, you're new to the artistic director. Do you feel like a director who always felt like you wanted a larger picture, and as you say, a longer conversation,
mm-hmm.
fuller, is that something you are
interested in?
I do.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say that when I was freelancing, I loved being able to travel and see new cities, and that was and to follow the work wherever. But I did in the summers. I felt like I got to engage in a bigger conversation because I think places like the O'Neill and Stage and Film and the Playwright Center, you know, where there really is a convening of artists of all kinds, there's an ability to have some of those bigger conversations.
Right.
But otherwise, project to project, I was feeling like my purview as a director was only inside the story. And there were a few times in the last couple of years when I would come to the end of a production and I would think that was really beautiful and I loved it and I'm glad that, you know, X number of people will get to see it, but how can I connect this to some of the bigger questions mm-hmm. that feel so urgent right now? And as a freelancer, there was no ability to do that.
Right, okay. So speaking of directing, are you going to be directing shows at Profile?
I am. We'll be in the fall. I'll be doing we're doing Kiara Hudes's play Water by the Spoonful in rotating rep with The Happiest Song Plays Last with the same design team and most of the same actors in both plays.
The same Elliot, obviously.
The same Elliot, the same Yaz. And it's the first time that those two plays have been presented that way.
Hmm.
And it's also with the same designers, director, and cast in rotating rep at the same time.
Has a trilogy never been presented together?
Not in rep.
Not in rep, okay.
Right,
okay.
Over the course of the season, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But not in rep. And also, The Happiest Song Plays Last will be in a slightly different draft than was seen either in Ashland or in New York, which we're excited to put on stage.
Speaking of Che Yu, here's my pitch to you. Mm-hmm. I just came up with it. One of the formative experiences of my life was seeing his White Lands trilogy at East West Players. It's Porcelain, Language of Their Own, and a third play, which I should remember the name of, but I don't remember. Mm-hmm. It might have been called White Lands. It was sort of a family play. And that ran in rep at East West Players as a sort of angels, like two. Well, you know what? It was one program, I guess. It wasn't. That's not really rep.
Hmm.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
he's a writer of color.
Sure.
Of course, he runs his own theater, but he doesn't really do his own plays there.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
And also, I asked him about Language of Their Own, which was such a great play. But you know, whether it would be revived, and he's like, I don't know. he's cagey about his own work.
Yeah.
But,
right. Sure.
But you have no. You know, the good news is, I suppose, that you have no shortage of writers to choose from.
That's for sure.
You know.
Yeah.
They may not get as many stagings as they should, but they're out there and they're doing the work. And
that's right. In a way, that's the easy part, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I sat down with somebody recently and was asking them, like, well, it was Brandon Jacob Jenkins, about mm-hmm. if you ran the signature, who would you?
Mm-hmm.
It was fun to just shoot back and forth the names of people, like, oh, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that person.
Right.
You know.
That's right.
It's fun, and there was all variety of people, but I'm sure wish lists, you have a long wish list, maybe.
And he's on it, to be honest.
Brandon?
Oh,
yeah, totally.
Yeah. And what a diversity of styles in his body of work, which is
something else
that we think of when we're thinking of programming a writer.
And you obviously have to have the writer's cooperation, not just for the rights, mm-hmm. but you want them to be involved in some mm-hmm. level.
For sure, yeah.
Does Kiara, does she come out?
She'll come out in November.
That's awesome.
And Lisa will come out sometime next year as well for a residency.
That's great. that's great. And then I guess the last question, you're going to direct some of the plays, but you're going to obviously curate a direct,
For sure.
a directing pool that's going to take, have different takes on the work.
Absolutely. And we've committed to making sure that there are women and people of color directing productions every single season.
Right.
That our design teams are inclusive and diverse.
I guess my last question for you would be, well, maybe not my last, but one last, is what's the talent pool like here? You know, do you feel like there's you can cast from here, you can find the directors here, or is it more of a conversation and a regional question?
The talent is absolutely here, in sort of all of the departments.
Right.
There's some great directors here. There's some great actors here. Reed has a great design program, so there's some great designers here on the faculty and coming out of that program. And I am also interested in mixing that with some out-of-town artists, because I think that's the way that ideas can really germinate and cross-pollinate.
Josh, pleasure to catch
Pleasure to catch up with you.
After these many years, you know, maybe we'll sublet from you sometime in Portland.
Exactly,
right?
That's right. I'll look forward to it.
Back with some recommendations of things you should see, read, think about. Helen, since you're a guest, you can go first.
Well, just a few days ago, I saw Spoon River, which is one of the shows that Soulpepper, the Canadian company, has brought. They're doing a kind of a micro season at the Signature. And Spoon River is just a great, big, Silver Age, humanist, encyclopedic tribute to kind of personhood, in a beautiful kind of Thornton Wilder-esque way. And it also has these great songs. And I loved that completely without reservation. And I would recommend it. Tonight I'm seeing Hamlet with,
oh my God, I'll be there too,
with
so.
Oscar Isaac, along with kind of everyone else we know. And I don't know if I can recommend it yet, but I think it would be weird to not see a Hamlet directed by Sam Gold. I think that would be kind of an odd choice if you're a theater nut.
Right.
To say, nah, that's okay. I don't like the play. You
well,
know,
right, you right. can't afford it either.
Oh, is it expensive? She said in that
expensive.
Awful critic gets like, free tickets away. How much is it? How much is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How much is it?
$75 probably, right?
No, I think it's in the 100 something.
And is it sold out?
Yeah.
Because this guy's...
I'm going to...
Has
double, triple
Damlet in it.
Poe Damlet.
I have heard.
I mean, Time and Beautiful Things was also in the 100 range too. Like it's
I've heard
weird, it's a
tiny.
Very,
weird buzz about this one.
Yeah. Member tickets is 75 for Hamlet, and tickets start at 115.
Interesting.
115.
So if you're a member, it's 75.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, at least Public's in the name, if not in the mission.
I think that's fair. How much would it have been at Jeffrey Horowitz's outfit? I'd like to know. All right. Deep, what do you have?
Well, I just got back from vacation, so I have not seen very much theater. But I am going to recommend a Netflix show because it's theater. We can recommend things that are theater related, but not.
Magical. Is this the one written by two lady playwrights?
I bet it's the Sexy Will Shakespeare Show.
Oh, not that one.
No, no.
It's not GLOW.
Oh, yeah. No, not the Will Shakespeare Show. Yes to GLOW.
Yeah. Carly mentioned Liz Flahive. How do you say her name?
Yeah.
Flahive. Yeah. Go on.
Well, Yes is written by two lady playwrights and also co-created by Jenji Cohen of Orange is the
New
Black.
Oh, yeah. That too. Yeah. Rachel Schuchert, one of the writers. Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah. This delightful half-hour comedy about the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. I have to admit, I was born in 88, so I was not privy to the gorgeous ladies of wrestling, but... Now I wish I was.
Yeah.
Because growing up watching WWE, I was an aggressive person at that time, so it was just too much male testosterone for my taste. So GLOW is about the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. It's a fictionalized story. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about it is it's a half-hour comedy, and so there's not a lot of... I mean, there's a central conflict, but there's not a lot of darkness within it. It's surprisingly, considering that it's set in the 80s and it's a bunch of women controlled by male director to
play fight each other.
Right.
It's surprisingly light.
Huh.
And in the pilot, Alison Brie talks about how she acted in Nebraska at the Blue Barn Theater,
I heard a clip of that, and I'm like, they got it right. They looked it up. There's a Blue Barn Theater in Nebraska.
There is a Blue Barn
Theater. Ibsen at the Blue Barn Theater. Genius. Yeah, I heard a clip. I haven't seen it yet, but I was like, okay, well, at least they did their research, right? Yeah. I mean, of course they would, because they have two playwrights who wrote it, right?
But yeah, no, but between GLOW and Wonder Woman, it's been a good summer for women fighting on screen.
Has TCG ever tried to do product placement? You know, like...
To put American theater in the...
Oh, yeah. We put American theater in Smash.
Did you? Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you should obviously be doing this in GLOW. I mean, TCG member theaters can you get them to mention in a season?
Oh, the TCG member theaters, totally. Yeah, we want to see a resume, a screenshot of her resume, and like have all these TCG. Yeah, that'd be awesome. I will write that on spec for them and come up with the hilarious plays she did. Anyway, I was on vacation too, so I'm going to recommend just something I read today that is, as Dee pointed out, is in our sort of We Wish We Wrote This Story file. Mm. Eric Piepenberg wrote a beautiful, really kind of... pause giving, I guess is the right.
It's very intimate. I love
story
it.
About the actors in Cost of Living, the Martina Mayock play at Manhattan Theater Club, which is a play about characters with disabilities played by actors with disabilities. But it's just something you don't think about as an audience member or as someone who's even like pro hired disabled actors. They're not all the same. You know, you can't. It's still an effort to play disability on stage. It's not like you just. Be mm-hmm. the
be who you are.
Be the disability. Mm-hmm. Both of them. I think one of them, Greg Mazzola, has cerebral palsy.
Yeah, but he's not wheelchair bound.
He's not wheelchair bound. I forget the other Miss Sullivan. I don't remember her name.
Katie Sullivan.
Right. She's also not wheelchair bound, and both of them have to use a wheelchair on stage. Anyway, it was such an interesting read. Talking about it was a piece about actors' craft and art. Mm. You know, it just happened to be about disabled actors.
Well, yeah, and, like how actors with disability like navigate a stage.
Well, there's that. Yeah, yeah. In that case, it just was a really thought provoking piece. Eric Piepenberg in
the
New York Times.
In the New York Times,
which was the subject.
What's
of,
that? No. Tell us more about it.
This newspaper that nobody reads, no one listens to.
On that exciting note, there'll be all sorts of great American theater stories to read online too this week. So look for those. Not that one, unfortunately. Thank you for coming by, Helen.
My pleasure. Thank you so
Another
much.
Another scintillating discussion, Deep. Rate us on iTunes, all that stuff that we say. All the links to things we talked about will be on the show page, right?
Yep. Ron Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes. Tell people.
All right. Take care. Bye.